So, Micah, how did you come to be part of the peace movement?
Accidentally. I was in the process of coming out as a lesbian, living in Manchester, and a lot of the women that I knew in Manchester were very politicised, and I used to go along to, what was it called? There was a bookshop, a radical left-wing bookshop in central Manchester, and through going there, and I don't actually think I attended any meetings at that stage, but I was talking to the woman who worked in the shop, and she was telling me, she must have told me about a meeting, and I went along to a meeting, and it was about Greenham more than it was actually about peace as a bigger thing, and I, that was how I got involved.
And what year was that?
1982.
Okay. And had you heard of Greenham before that, or the rumblings of it, or was it right at the beginning?
It wasn't right at the beginning. It was. Must have been the summer. So it had been stuff had been going on there already for a little while. And I'd heard a little bit, mainly again through the women's network at the time in Manchester.
And are you from Manchester originally?
No, I was originally from near Birmingham, and I travelled around, and I. But mostly, I went from Birmingham to Manchester, and that was where I came out. And after that, I travelled around there.
And you just mentioned it then, and then so that was how you heard about Greenham. And was that also the first time that you went then?
The first time I went was on the Embrace the Base action, and I went on a coach of. I think it was all women and kids that went down from Manchester.
Yeah. And how, what was it like?
It was quite overwhelming. It was really exciting. And it was, we all got up really early in the morning. And so, you know, when you're doing something, you travel down in the coach all together. That builds the feeling about it a lot. And so, yeah, we were all getting really excited. It was a long way from Manchester, of course. And then we got there, and it was just... When we actually arrived... I'm really trying to remember. It was like the place itself had... somehow assume this significance that, and even though when you got there and what you saw was disappointing in a way because it was just a chain link fence, but of course there were loads and loads of women and loads of women arriving and singing and dressed up and embracing the base, you know, with all holding hands and everything, and that feeling of being with so many other women doing the same thing together and being absolutely convinced that it was the right thing to be doing made it really powerful.
Yeah.
And I was 24 and I'd just never been involved in anything like that before, and I'd always been a little bit of an outsider. And I made myself be funny, which is what most people do. Well, you know, you either stay shy and on the outskirts or you be funny as a way of being in, really. And so that's what I did. But I never really felt like I was properly part of something. Yeah. But this was so big and the women were so varied. There was no way you could not be within that group, which was lovely.
Yeah, that was amazing.
It was lovely. And to feel that feeling of strength and camaraderie at the same time as knowing you were doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Of course, goddess, heroine, everything, you know, it was all in one go. It was brilliant.
Oh, that's incredible. And did you stay then after Embrace the Base, or did you go back to Manchester?
No, we went back. It was a day trip.
Yeah.
And it was after Christmas that the Manchester group, there was going to be a peace march in Manchester, but nobody from Greenham would come and speak at the peace march. And having been there, I understand, because the number of requests all the time was so massive. So people were prioritising being there. But so the Manchester group said, well, but any woman is a Greenham woman, every woman is a Greenham woman, so somebody from here can go,
yeah.
stay there for a little while, and come back and speak at the march. So yeah. I said, pick me, pick me. I was very keen, and I was chosen.
Excellent.
Which was great, yeah. Thank you very much. And so I went, and I stayed for a week,
mm-hmm.
and... it was cold, there was snow, mm-hmm. and I remember having to sleep with my hat on.
Yeah.
And the place that I slept, I had a sleeping bag, but somebody had given me a really lovely down sleeping bag, which is a bit rubbish when it's damp, which it was. So that was. But there was this hotel, they called it the hotel,
mm.
and it was there was a washing line, and there was pallets with straw on top, and loads of blankets,
yeah.
and everybody put their... sleeping bags in there, so that's where I slept. But it was yeah. cold because it was long,
yeah, okay.
and it was only plastic over the top, so it was not, you know, even less insulation than a tent, which
yeah.
is made of top stuff. And but I just had a fantastic time, and I got home, and I went to my flat, and I got in the bath, and I had to have the window open because I was already claustrophobic being indoors in a house
yeah.
after just a week. When I was in the bath and just the heat and the steam.
Yeah.
And, but I was fairly clean when I went and did the speak, which I can't remember. I remember walking along in the march, but I can't remember anything about speaking.
Mm.
And but I can't remember whether I stayed a couple of days back at home and then I went back off and that was it. And
yeah.
I didn't even unpack my flat. Other people sorted my flat out for
yeah.
me because that was it. I'd gone, I'd left
yeah.
and I was living at Greenham.
And how long did you live at Greenham altogether?
6 months about, I think. Yeah. It was February when I moved because mm. that's when the march was. And when in the August, a group of us went off and travelled around Ireland in a Morris Minor van and I was in that group, so that was when I left.
Was that 83?
Yeah.
And what gate were you at?
I lived at the Yellow Gate, which
okay.
at that time was known as the Main Gate
yeah.
because we hadn't got correct in that way
yeah.
about that. Yeah.
And at the time, did it have a set personality or was there a message behind why you chose it, or was it just where you ended up?
It was where I ended up.
Mm.
But there was, and the only ones where there were people living at the time that I moved there was the Main Gate and what was already known as the Green Gate.
Yeah.
But the Green Gate was called the Green Gate because it was in the woods,
mm.
not because of there being any kind of the rainbow thing,
yeah.
which came later. And it was while I was living there, some women went and set up on the other side and I think opened the Blue Gate.
Mm.
But... So there wasn't a great deal of choice,
mm.
and I used to go and visit at the Green Gate, but I liked the buzz and the liveliness of what was happening at
yeah.
the Main Gate, at the Yellow Gate.
How old were you, did you say?
I was 24, yeah.
And did you know anybody as well when you went down?
No.
Did you just make friends?
I did not know a soul.
Were you scared?
I was a bit intimidated. I remember during the week when I went... people not being terribly friendly.
Oh, okay.
And I mean, they were friendly and welcoming, mm. but they weren't properly friendly. And I didn't notice insofar as the difference between that and when I went back.
Mm.
And I remember somebody saying to me, people say they're going to come back all the time and people are coming and going. And that was definitely something that happened at the Yellow
yeah.
Gate. People were coming and going all the time. And so you couldn't sort of give your heart to people who you didn't know whether they
yeah,
were going to be back again. But when I did go back and I said, right, I'm here now, I was welcome very much in,
mm.
and it was not difficult to make friends at all.
Yeah.
Especially as I had my hairdressing scissors with me and I cut people's hair.
That's a good way to get in.
Anybody wanted their hair cut? I didn't know that was what was going to happen. And I don't even remember why I took my scissors with me.
Yeah.
Of all the things, you know, I took a rucksack with my entire worldly goods.
Mm.
And I took my hairdressing scissors.
It's almost like trading cigarettes.
Yeah.
Instead of haircuts at Greenham.
Yeah, I cut really short hair. And everybody really liked the way it felt, but of course it meant the police couldn't get hold of your hair
yeah.
when it was really short. And so there was several different reasons, but the sensory touchy thing of it was really nice. And then some of the women criticised me for making everybody look like they were from Belsen. But... you know, because there was a lot of disagreements as well as agreements.
Yes. And what made you decide to stay for those months that you were there?
Oh, there was no... it was a feeling. It wasn't the thinking, really. As soon as I was there, somebody showed me how to sign on in Newbury. And was it Newbury? Yeah, it must have been Newbury. And that was kind of it. I'd gone back because I just couldn't not be there. Mm. It felt like it was the hub of the universe. And in fact, I remember this one woman, Jill, she moved, she'd been living in New York, right in Manhattan. Mm. And she said, well, I was bored with New York, so where else could I come? I had to be here.
Yeah.
You know, and it felt like that. Yeah. It really felt like it was the most important place in the world for that little time to those of us who were there.
Yeah.
It was so vibrant.
Mm. And there's a lot said about kind of the art and everything that was created, and you talked about hairdressing and art as well. And did you see a lot of that when you were there?
The weaving of the webs and all of that was happening a lot. People were doing that sort of thing all the time. And you couldn't... And I think there was the feeling of doing this action sort of ferment. It was like almost volcanic, that the energy rising because of everybody being there and involved doing the same thing together. And that is a creative feeling.
Mm.
But you couldn't paint because everything got wet.
Yeah.
And if you were worrying, which we were, being evicted a lot of the time, then everything was getting lost all the time. You couldn't write because of that. You couldn't really, you know, I ended up coming away without any contacts with people except those that I was with when I left, because you didn't have paper.
Mm.
Because it was lost and it got wet and it just fell to pieces. So to make anything, any externalising of that feeling, that a statement of it, had to be some sort of sculptural thing, and that's why I think the kinds of art that was made was the sort of stuff that it was. And there was also the, I mean, we knew that what we were doing was transitory, and we were making things with leaves and twigs, which is, you know, they would disappear, and because we were getting more and more aware about the ecological stuff as well as peace at the same time, we were also not wanting to make things that were going to damage the earth, because there was the base with this death making thing to kill the world, and so we didn't want to be involved in that. We wanted to be making things that would not damage it, would not, you know, would be gone easily, and not that thing about leave only footprints, like that sort of.
That's so interesting. I've never heard that before, that kind of interpretation of the artistry is so important and stuff. And I also have wondered, because spoken to a couple of other women, they've not kept in touch with any of the women that they were there with. Obviously that makes so much sense. How would you be able to you don't have anything to write it down with, or it gets wet or lost?
I've found women almost accidentally in the time since, and I left with a group of women who I'm not in touch with any of them anymore. We squatted in London and things just fell apart a bit. We were not united by that common bond anymore, really, I suppose, and we all started to just want to do other things. And I think we also, I certainly wanted to be able to do something with what had happened to me, because it was transforming. And because we were squatting and moving around, that took a lot of energy, and so that part of the reason it all fell apart. And then when I moved up here, I met somebody who I'd known there, and but by and large, there was a woman who was in Ireland that I met again, you know, just almost accidentally meeting people. And Facebook hasn't really helped, because people rarely say on Facebook that they were involved in Greenham. It's strange. And I think what happened after, the culturally in the wider culture, made us not particularly want to even talk about it, I think.
Yeah, and
I think I felt a bit silenced.
Yeah, oh, that's really sad. It's really interesting that is how you felt. And do you feel like the media at the time as well, and like you said afterwards, that made you kind of retreat and not want to talk about it?
I think also there was a bit of a misunderstanding. We were misunderstood, and the media did that, of making you into these... And I said being a heroine and a goddess earlier, but making us into something that we weren't really. And people would come in while we were living there, and women, especially women with kids, would shake my hand and say, thank you for doing this for us, which was lovely. But I'd said to them, I'm not doing it for you. I'm doing it. I'm just doing it. And it wasn't for anybody else. So there was that. You know, women can only be two kinds of person. You've got to be sort of a bleeding and damaged and always, of course, doing it for somebody else.
Yeah.
And I did not want to be connected to that stereotype of, you know, I mean, I'm happy enough to be a nurturer, but no, I was not going to be the sacrificer of myself. And anyway, it was too much fun to be sacrificial. So,
yeah, that's really interesting. And did you find that a lot, that women would come up to you and say thank you for doing that?
Yeah, and men.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because men used to come and visit.
Yeah. That's really interesting.
So, yeah, it was common. And then, of course, when we moved away, I was in the squatter community, and a lot of the women have been there, and a lot of the men have been at mixed peace camps.
Mm.
So there was no particular need to talk about it. But then as my life sort of moved on, it did become something that was, it's not like exactly shameful, but it was a bit like my dirty past. And I do think that the media, and at the time, how long would that have been? Mid-80s, everything started to get very glamorised, and so maybe it's to do with just that.
What I found really weird about the whole thing is, and I find this as well with the miners' strike, is it's kind of like, it's not over, you know, there's still ramifications, things like this, but the actual event is done.
Yeah.
Mining as an industry.
Yeah,
the way that it did. But there are politicians from that time who still are in politics who act like it's still happening.
Yeah.
And they have this viciousness about what happened. It's like, it was 35 years ago, let it go. And I do find that with, when I've told people about this project, a lot of people have been really supportive, but some people have been like, oh, great, I'm just, and I'm like, let it go. Like, it was so long ago. Why do you still hold on to this? But it must be something about people's identities and what they see themselves in opposition to and the other and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I've been shocked that the prejudices that kind of hold the people hold on to, that I just find baffling. To me, it's a historical event that happened. We should talk about it, analyse it, listen to people who were there, learn from it.
Yeah, and I think because it was a women's action,
I think
that was a lot stronger. And you know, if you watch a quiz on the telly, nobody ever knows the answers about women. And even women don't know the answers about women. Women's stuff just gets forgotten.
Yeah.
And so it's so much more that it was. And I think that we were sort of, once it was over, we were actively being squashed.
Mm-hmm.
Not consciously, I don't think. But there was some squashing because it was such an outburst of powerful female energy.
Mm.
And even though, I mean, and the missiles did get taken away, and who knows whether it was the action that was the reason for that or not. But I think it was a big igniter in women's consciousness around the country. And I think that therefore had to be stopped.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I also think that's probably one of the reasons why it hasn't been historicised in the way that the miners' strike has.
Exactly.
Because it's the leaders of that women.
Yeah.
And also this, and to an extent, the miners' strike, sorry, I keep going on both, but it...
Well, they were the same time, and we noticed a difference in the way the police responded to us because of the miners' strike. They became a lot more violent.
Yeah,
so it was exactly the same time.
Yeah, and... Yeah, and also led by men, but also is part of a national story of industry. Whereas the Greenham thing is anomalous in the way that it's part of still a contentious movement, the peace movement and activism. And and I think maybe that's one of the reasons, and that it was led by women and made up of entirely women.
Yeah.
And didn't kowtow to politicians, like, you know, the ins and outs of the miners' strike and whatever, but, you know, had quite close links with politicians.
Yes.
whereas Greenham did it anyway.
Oh, it was so much itself. But I do remember people coming and visiting, and they would say, "Who's the leader?" And we'd all say me, or we'd all say her, on purpose. But yeah. You know, and it was fun. But there was also meaning in that, because it was completely anarchistic. We did have meetings and discuss things that were important, but there was nobody telling anybody what to do.
I was going to ask you about if it was important to you at the time that it was a women-only movement.
I don't think I would have been interested in going if it hadn't have been... I mean, I was coming out as a lesbian, so there was definitely that about it. But interestingly, it wasn't a hotbed of sex, and it wasn't a hotbed of celibacy either. You know, there was... people got together and had their hot sex, which you do when you're in the beginning of a relationship, you know, and you could hear it, because we weren't living in walled buildings. But it was... that wasn't why people came. Somebody, I remember a woman who'd been in prison coming along and saying she'd come because it was a peace camp and she needed a bit of peace. And she had totally not comprehended that. But then, you know, why shouldn't it also be peace is that too, you know, so fair enough. But, yeah, I think it was so much more interesting. And because men were doing everything, and that was really boring.
Yeah. And did you find that in the Manchester, when talking about the peace movement that you were sort of involved with in the Radical Bookshop, did you find those gender power structures that you didn't find at Greenham? I was speaking to some people who were part of the CND movement, and they said, you know, the men were just...
Yeah, I was never anything to do with CND. So I didn't experience that, but I do know that that's the case. And I remember speaking to people from Greenpeace who said, you know, it's only ever the men who get to do any of the radical actions. And we did, while I was living at Greenham, we did go and visit Faz Lane and spoke to a woman who was there, and she, the way she was talking, it was clear that it was the men who did everything. And she was really curious about how we were able to anarchistically decide things and have the people who wanted to do it do it, and the people who didn't want to do it didn't have to do it, and you know, and the ones who didn't do it didn't have to be the bottle washer either. You know, so but it was just so much more interesting, because it was different, but it was also about me automatically. So I just, and I hadn't been involved in the peace movement previously. It hadn't been attractive, although the idea of a peaceful planet, of course that's attractive, but the movement was not.
Yeah, I found that definitely with political movements, and especially local Labour Party that I'm part of. I found it very men who've been there for 40 years and it's their turn. Whereas women's only creative spaces and things like that, you feel automatically welcomed. That you have and you're right, like a lot of the women I've spoken to have said similar things about the decision making process. Your choice was respected, essentially. I want to talk about that as well, in terms of how it worked when you were there with the decision making. People have talked about the meetings that happened and a talking stick and things like that.
We didn't have a talking stick at the meetings I went to. They haven't been invented yet, I don't think. I think there was a talking stick just before I left, and I didn't really understand it. And we used to have rows sometimes at the meetings, and sometimes, because those little personal stereos had just come in, and we had little cassette players, but because you were wearing a hat, you could actually have your headphones in secretly and nobody would know, and some people did attend the meetings and just sit there nodding, and they were not into the music, not to the decisions being made, so there was even anarchism going on in that. But the decision making, some people would have an idea, and it would depend on kind of the bigness of the idea. You might just tell a few people and go and do the thing that you did. So a few of us just went and slept in the base overnight because that's what we were going to do.
Mm.
And we didn't need anybody's permission, we just did it.
Mm.
And we left stuff in the base so that they knew that people had been there. We left things that made it obvious that we'd been there all night long. Can't remember, we didn't leave a sleeping bag. Maybe we did leave a blanket or something, and evidence of a fire. We probably left a blanket because that would have been a wool blanket and it would have just decayed away if it wasn't found or taken, wouldn't we? But I do remember it was very important to leave something. And but other things that so were bigger actions that were happening. And when I went down, there had been the over Christmas, the New Year's action that had already happened. And there was going to be the beginning of the court case, and I think that that's why Manchester was starting to get more involved, because of wanting to be able to support the court case as it went on. But there were other actions that, as a result of that, we knew that women may be going to go to prison, and then women were sent to prison because of it. And so bigger actions where we thought there was a possibility we might be going to be sent to prison, we did. That was the sort of thing that got talked about more at a meeting, and some women would say, well, I can't go to prison because I've got kids, and some would say, I really don't want to do this, and other women would say, that's totally fine by me. And I did actions that never led to me going to prison, but I think I had a civil action against me for one of the things, but I can't even remember what it was now. But it was, again, it was just, you kind of said, yeah, I'm in, and then you would be in, and then it wouldn't be meetings as such that you would have to work out how you were going to do a thing, but that's what they were. But they were just little informal, come on, let's go and talk about this.
Yeah.
And you would go and talk about something and work out how you were going to do it.
Mm. And the actions that you mentioned, is there a rough number? Do you remember how many that you were
involved
in? I
have no idea. Hundreds. I very much doubt it. But I just don't even know, you know, I can't remember. They were happening, little ones, big ones, they were happening all the time. I remember we had a naked blockade of the base because we thought the police wouldn't want to touch us, and that was true. We kept our boots on so that they dragged us. We wouldn't get our feet grazed, but they would drag you so that you banged your knees still. So that was annoying. And we had a snogging blockade because we thought that love would be something that nobody could object to, but of course they did. So, and you can probably tell that I was much more likely to be involved in things that had a bit of a lightness and a sense of humour about them, and that was the sort of thing I was attracted to, and so that was the sort of thing that I ended up doing more of.
Yeah, and did you enjoy doing that?
Yeah, it was scary, but it was exciting. I mean, adrenaline is it's a good drug. And then we would, after actions, we would all feel like shit the day after, because it's a drug, and you come down and you feel dreadful. Sometimes for 3 days if it was a really big action.
And were you said you were arrested once.
A few times. Yeah. I remember being held in the cells in Newbury overnight sometimes, and they'd dump us out in the middle of the night and at the other side of the base, so you had to walk all the way back. But I was never dumped on my own the other side of the base. I know some women were. And I think that depended who the duty officers were and just how misogynistic they were, I guess.
From the women that, again, I've interviewed, the actions of the police just seem quite petty.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it was, I don't even know, well, yeah, what was your experience? Was it kind of a pettiness?
Yeah. I remember. We had these links with Holloway Prison. We were doing quite a lot of stuff around women in prison and the fact that the majority of women in prison are there because they've been abused and because they've nicked to feed themselves and most lot often with about their children. And so we had links. We started, I don't know how, whoever it was that did it, but we started to have connections with the group, Women in Prison group. And we had set up a little camp on the pavement outside of Holloway Prison, which was only an ordinary width of pavement. And I remember this one policeman was being really petty about us being there. And we would moved our stuff so that people could walk by, but he was doing us for obstruction. And Jill, who was the one from New York that I mentioned earlier, she called him a wanker. And so he wrote it down in his liquor book, and I remember her going to court for having called him a wanker, because that was, I can't remember what, there was some terminology he used that made it into a case, offensive something or other. I don't know whether there's an offensive language. I mean, there were no hate crimes at that time.
Oh, public
indecency.
It might be
yeah.
like that.
So anyway, we were there in court. Jill, she was 40, so she was a proper grown-up. Says Micah from a considerably older position, but she'd been involved in art, a whole load of art stuff, political art in New York, and she's dead now. A lot of people are dead now, but I remember she addressed I think it was a judge, not even a magistrate, and she said, "Your Honour, who?" I did call him a wanker. He said that she'd shouted it. She said, "I use the same tone of voice as I'm using to you. I do have a voice that carries, but I don't ever have to raise it." And you could see that the judge was really thinking, I. And she said, "And to call somebody a wanker is merely saying that they masturbate. Who among us has not masturbated?" And the judge goes, bong, case dismissed. No, I mean, that's the sort of thing that happened.
Yeah. Just, a sense of humour, like you said. We've kind of answered this about non-violent direct action,
I didn't understand what non-violent direct action was at all.
When I went to the training day for this, I was like, what is non-violent? Production people were like, "Oh, protests." Oh yeah, cool. Just call it that.
Yeah, but I didn't understand what it even meant and why you couldn't slap somebody's hand off you, and you just had to simply allow yourself to be dragged away.
Yeah.
You know, the passivity of it. And I think that one of the things that we started doing with the naked blockade and the snogging blockade was we remained passive in that we didn't stop anybody from dragging us away, because by that point I did understand it. But we also thought, we're not going to be passive about this because we are women, and we can't be, because we're expected to be, so we mustn't be completely passive. And I think that also elevated things to a different level of creativity, because you have to think out the box, don't you?
And also a different level of consciousness as well, to say, like, actually there is a power in not being passive, but being, I won't interact with your violence.
Yeah.
Like, I find that really powerful, and really powerful about grieving, that it's creative in a sense that you're not even meeting male violence on its own terms, you're doing something completely different.
Yeah, and I think that was a very powerful consciousness raising for all of us. There were some women who'd already done consciousness raising things, but most of us had not.
Mm.
And there were some women who'd done stuff within the peace movement, and there were women who'd done women's groups from the women's movement, and those things came together. And then there were all the others of us who'd never done anything like it before. But then that raised consciousness that happened, we were putting everything together, and that's what really feminism is about, is about the connectedness.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it so radical. It's not like the Labour Party, and especially at the moment, it seems extremely blinkered and single track. With what was happening with our minds, we were seeing the connectedness of things and how everything was. We did blame it all on the patriarchy, and I don't know that it is necessarily all the patriarchy to blame, but I think that the damn sight, that particular power structure that is all about climbing to the top and trampling over everybody else underneath you, I do think that that is probably a lot of the reason of why we're in this mess, you know, ecologically speaking, because the planet comes last, doesn't it?
And people who are working, and women and children come last with all those conversations.
Yeah, always at the bottom of the pyramid.
And so what was your thought process at the time then, going from not understanding non-violent direct action, but not knowing what it was, and then moving to understanding it? What was Were there like pressure points where you started to understand more?
Not that I remember, but yeah. Perhaps there were. I think it was more like as if my life had been a jigsaw, and as time was going on during being there and being just exposed to people with such different lives and who'd got such different experiences and soaking it all up, it was as if the picture on the jigsaw was becoming visible, and that allowed me to see what this life is, what this world is, how everybody works. And I read something just today on Facebook about, and it was a guy who was talking, saying, well, the government, it was an article about gaslighting and narcissism in relationships, and he was saying, but it happens not only in relationships, and it is happening now, and the government is doing it now. And that sort of connecting is exactly the sort of connecting that we were doing back then, and I'm certain that that's why the movement sort of had to be quashed, because that level of awakeness about how we are all being drugged through the telly and through the drugs and into not thinking and not taking an action and not making any changes. And gaslighting even has a name now, which it didn't then. But it is being done. We're being told that what we know to be true is not. But it's interesting that gaslighting is something that it was imagined could only happen to women. And I guess that one of the things that is both good and bad is that people are now recognising that, no, it happens, and people use it to enforce power, and anybody who has power will use it on somebody who has less power, and it is the perfect tool if you're a politician. And of course it's gone on forever. That's all what 1984 is about.
But I think in a weird, not even in a good way, probably in the long term a good way, is that gaslighting is now not being, it maybe won't be used just for male-female relationships.
Yes.
It will be used for power structures, which essentially is what that was talking about, was male-female relationships.
Yeah.
It's a power structure. And hopefully it's now more.
Well, I guess if it's happening to men, it's going to get spoken about a bit more, isn't it?
That's a good thing. Not a good thing, but I'm happy that it's being talked about.
Well, that it's recognised as a thing.
Yeah, and it's frustrating that until it happens to men, it's not and also about relationships with men, we've already sort of talked about it, the relationship with the police, but also relationships with bailiffs, or the idea of bailiffs at Greenham, or the military as well, if you had any thoughts on those.
Didn't really have any connection with the guys in the base at all. They would go in their buses, and it was like they were scared to even look at us. So we did kind of play with that a little bit, with witch badges and doing witchy stuff. I remember there being a big thunderstorm and one night, and the lightning went around the base, around and around and around the base, and it was forked lightning. None of it was earthed, and it looked like dragons in the sky. We were all out there yelling and whooping and getting soaking wet and properly behaving like crazy women. I am not surprised those poor squaddies in the base were terrified. I think we were pretty scary when we got something on us like that. And I also remember I had the little badge that said witch on it. And I don't remember what his name was. The Tory politician from Newbury came up to speak to us. And I spoke to him. I can't remember what it was that I said. But I do remember it appearing in the paper the following week that when he went, he was spoken to by one of the witches. And he's never been ill before, but he lost his voice as a result. And I do know that I was thinking, you're an idiot, just shut up. So maybe I did make him lose his voice.
What a claim.
I know.
That's incredible.
That was really funny. And then people came up looking for the witch who'd put the cursed him and made him lose his voice. And so then again, everybody's going, it hurts. And she under the bench.
That's incredible. But also that he believed it. That's amazing.
I know. And because Well, you don't expect them to believe in woo-woo people no. like that, do you?
And I was also going to ask, relationship with local residents, if you had any interaction with them and if it was possible.
Well, there were a few local women who let us go to their houses for baths and were really, really supportive. But mostly, I didn't have anything really bad happen. People used to call us kippers. People used to sniff because we smelled like wood smoke as we were walking down the street, and people would shout names after us, like lesbian, and we'd say, yeah, yeah, and, you know. But we didn't go to Newbury on our own. We would always go in a group, partly because it was damn sight more convenient, because somebody would have a car and you would go together in the car because it was a long way to walk back. But it would have been scary to go on your own because there was distinct hostility. Lots of the pubs wouldn't let us in, lots of the cafes wouldn't let us in, you know. And when we were queuing to sign on, there were definitely, you know, like, well, and people would say, well, what are you doing? Well, you're in the queue behind me, you know, I'm saving the world, what are you doing? Because we were not abashed by people saying things like that, because we were fired up with the radicalism of what it was that we were doing. But again, we weren't on our own.
Yeah. Do you think it was, like you said, the community that you were in kind of bolstered people?
It gave us power and confidence and safety in numbers.
Mm.
Definitely.
And the people that were kind in Newbury, how did you meet them? Or they come to Greenham?
I think mostly they'd come and visit.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And they would come and say, I live locally, and somehow or other we then found out where they lived, and they would have given somebody their address, and when somebody would be taking a car, and a few of us would go and have a bath. I was ill actually, and I went and stayed at one somebody's house.
Oh, that's
because I was too poorly.
Yeah, I've wondered about kind of the general domestic admin of a camp before, and kind of like, I remember asking somebody about tampons. I was like, well, where did you get them from? She was like, the shop.
Yeah. we had adult checks.
Yes.
So we did have money.
Yeah.
And people would bring a lot of food. So we actually had a reasonably good amount of disposable income, because we didn't get any rent money.
Yeah.
So that wasn't an issue. But we got a lot of food donated, and people would arrive, come in for a short period of time, and they would often bring food and drugs and alcohol. So there was, you know, we were not going short as far as those kinds of things were concerned. So, and we just went into Newbury and bought the things that we wanted. So we might buy particular food that we might want, or if we were going to make a meal, we'd go, because sometimes you would make... Usually there would be a big meal being made pretty much, I think, every day. But people would also go off and make a little fire if they wanted something else, or a bit of space, a bit of privacy. And so then you'd buy your own food, probably. Or there was a place where loads of food was kept. And you would take something.
Yeah. And when did you leave the last time? Was it 83?
It was still the same year, and it will have been August.
Yeah. And did you not go back after that?
No.
Why?
I'm not sure, you know. We were up and down to London a bit before, and to the Holloway thing, and to some of the women who were living in London, you know, they would visit as well. So we'd go and stay with people for a few days. But when I left, and we were squatting and we were living in London, I became very involved in that, but I didn't have transport, and so to actually get back was quite difficult. When I used to be living there, I would get the coach from London to Greenham, or from Greenham to London if I was going on a trip, unless we were going in a car. But it was just awkward, because from Newbury it was a long walk to get to the camp itself. But it did also feel a bit like, by the time I was leaving, there was starting to be more women moving out, and so Greenham for me wasn't necessarily there at the camp. It was to do with that group of women that I was with, and there was this whole big women's squatting community in Hackney where it was that I was living, and so Greenham was there.
Yeah. So this question might not be relevant, or maybe your thoughts on it. How much do you think the camp was infiltrated or sabotaged towards the end?
I've got no clue. I really didn't experience that, and maybe I'd already gone by the time anything of that type. I've no idea. It was not something that I experienced at all.
And do you feel that there is a legacy of Greenham within the feminist or LGBT? Or
I think feminists are a bit ashamed of Greenham.
Do you think?
Yeah, I think now it's probably getting a little bit more kudos again.
Yeah.
But I think during the 90s, it was a bit of a dirty secret, a bit of a guilty thing. And I certainly didn't really talk about it among the feminists I was around. But then feminism took a real nosedive anyway.
Yeah.
So maybe the whole thing was just part of all one thing that was happening about the, you know, the lashback against it.
Yeah.
So I'm not certain. I mean, definitely when I look at the other things that I've done in my life since, I can see how connected to my life at Greenham they were. They are.
Yeah.
Definitely everything that I've done since has been informed by it. Absolutely. But I don't know that everybody has. I do remember bumping into somebody and she was talking about how everybody had sort of gone straight with their Greenham stuff that they'd learned. But no, we were becoming counsellors and therapists and stuff like that, and that's not really going straight, is it?
No,
it's still very much work to help people transform their lives. So, and I mean, I was a therapist for some time, and I was working with people who'd been sexually abused and ritually abused, and you know, it was proper heavy end stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think a lot of us were doing that kind of work.
Mm.
And a lot of other kind of ways of just not going along with the mainstream, continuing to challenge the status quo, even if not necessarily visibly.
Yeah.
But I mean, certainly in Todmorden, where I live now, there's a lot of women who are at Greenham there, and farming and, you know, living on the land and being carrying on the legacy in that way, being close to the land. There's all sorts of different ways that we have interpreted what we experience there.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting what you say about therapists and counsellors, and it's what you said before about, I'm not doing this for you, I'm doing this for me. And I wonder if those two things are connected as well. It's not a caring profession, but it's a much more empathetic profession than most others.
Yeah.
I don't know, but because there's other women that I've spoken to who have done exactly the same, they're counsellors or they're therapists, and I can't help feeling that is connected in some way.
I definitely think the transformation that I experienced through living at Greenham meant that I was aware that people's lives can be transformed. And I think I wanted more of that.
Yeah.
And while I was therapying, you know, and it was, some of the work that I was doing was really, really raw, but it still didn't feel sacrificial of myself to do it. And in fact, when it did start to, because I wasn't getting external support, then I stopped doing it. But there was that. Because actually, people would say to me, how can you do this work? How can you bear it, hearing such horrible stories from people? And I said, because it's amazing to see, to know how people have sustained themselves and the resilience of people. And that's just an absolutely inspiring thing to be involved in. And so the line between those makes it very clear. To see somebody getting hold of their life, and I mean, not necessarily going from being abject to being completely powerful, but to certainly be part of that journey, it's really inspiring.
Yeah. And I find it interesting that, from what you said, people would people would expect you to internalise what they were saying to you. Why would you? You're a professional. And obviously I'm not saying that it wouldn't have been very hard and taxing in a professional sense, but why is it expected that you as a woman would therefore
because that's what women do though, isn't it? That's exactly what women do, is absorb everybody else's shit and deal with everybody else's shit. And often as well, by internalising it and then having passive-aggressive behaviours. You know, everybody's, well, not everybody, but many of us have been around a mother who silently simmered as she made the Christmas dinner, you know.
Did you enjoy being? Were you a therapist?
Yeah, I was a therapist for nearly 20 years in the voluntary sector in Manchester, and I really enjoyed it.
Mm.
And when I stopped doing it, I really felt like I'd lost my identity, but I had to, because the support systems, the charity I was working in closed down.
Mm.
Before that, for a while, just before that, the support systems within it crumbled, and I was doing such heavy work, I couldn't carry on. So, yeah, I really missed it, but I stopped. But, you know, now I run the only company of women plumbers in the world.
Yes,
so.
I saw. How did you come to do that?
Oh, accidentally. No clear plan, ever. No, my partner started Stop Cox when she, in 1990, she trained as a plumber. She left being a teacher.
Yeah.
And she trained to be a plumber. And because she'd always wanted to be, and always was, had been, very practical.
Mm.
And she carried on. Many women at around about the similar time, late 80s, were training in manual trades.
Mm.
But a lot of them, and I knew quite a few of them when I lived in London, and many of them just didn't carry on doing it. And when there had been the GLC in London, the GLC employed a lot of women.
Mm.
But I guess things changed as well when the GLC collapsed. But Hattie always worked for herself because when she started working as a plumber, nobody would give her a job. So she thought, right then, because she had bills to pay. So she set up working for herself. And her company was immediately called Stop Cox. It's not a name that's been made up for Twitter. It's a name that's come out of her very much carry-on film influence.
Yes,
sense of humour. But so she was Stop Cox Woman Plumber for a long time. But when she got a computer and she had a little website, women started contacting her saying, how do I become a plumber? And she looked at all the different ways that she might be able to do it, and they were all over the country, and she thought, well, I can't employ them because they're all over the place, and most of them didn't even know how to be a plumber, and they wanted apprenticeships. And she thought if I have one apprentice, then all my energy is going to go into that one woman, and that would mean that she could therefore not support all the other women who wanted to become plumbers. So she looked at different ways to do it, and she joined an entrepreneurs network as well at the same time, and they were saying to let people know about what you're doing and gather your tribe around you, go where the tribe are. And, well, but they're so scattered, there is no tribe of tradeswomen. So she started writing newsletters and one by one contacting women, but again, that took tons of energy.
Yeah.
And I was with her by this point that she was starting to do this, and I was kind of a little bit helping, but not so much because I was still therapying. But I guess my feminist perspective on things had an influence all along a little bit. So from trying to contact women individually, she thought, that's just taking too much time and too much energy, and I still have my own living to make. So she thought, no, I'll just make myself more visible. And that started happening at the same time as websites became easier and cheaper to be able to produce. And then what has really made the difference has been social media, which is one of the things that I particularly do within the business. I mostly do marketing.
Yeah.
And I mean, I do answer the phone to people when they ring as well, and hand out advice to people all over the place who wanted to become plumbers and stuff like that. And I do interviews and write articles, but it's mostly marketing. And social media has really made it possible for women in the industry to become very, very much more visible. But I do think I'm constantly being drawn to being the campaigning Micah from my Greenham time, and it's still really, it's important to have that. But we're actually a business, and we've never had any funding from anybody for the business, and so the business has to always be able to stand on its own two feet, but that gives it massive independence.
Yeah.
Recently we've started, we're just now doing our third conference, and we do get sponsorships from companies within the industry to be able to do that, and I lead organising that.
Mm.
So we do get little tiny bits of funding as sponsorships, but that's specifically for the use to be able to promote the conference, and it is the only opportunity for women plumbers to get together. And at the first conference, there were women there who had never seen another woman plumber, even though they'd been working in the industry some time.
Yeah, that's amazing.
There's only 1 in 100 plumbers are women, and of the 100,000 gas engineers in this country, there are 500 women gas engineers, that's all. And it's a similar number with electricians to the gas engineers. And in fact, an electrician came along to the last one and she crewed because she wanted to be able to do something, but on her own, you can't do it on your own. I was able to devote a lot of time to it because Hattie was doing the plumbing, and it was just part of my running the business.
Yeah, what an incredible thing.
Yeah. And Hattie is the one that makes, and she's the galvanising force.
Mm.
That's not the stuff that I do. I'm a brilliant number two. And second, and you know, I think leaders, forget leaders, they're not important. Having somebody who'll actually get the shit done, that's actually at least as important. And that's what it is that I do, is I make it all happen.
Yeah, sounds fantastic.
It's good. It's finally, we're getting some recognition, and having been plodding away and not recognised and not paid for all the things that we've been doing for all this time. The whole business has been supported just by Hattie Plumbing for a long time. And now there are enough women around the country who are stopcock plumbers, so we've got, the business is more than standing on its own feet financially, and is starting to pay us a little bit. But we still have, Hattie still does plumbing, and you know, we're hoping to be able to get her paid speaking gigs and stuff like that to be able to properly pay us, so that she doesn't have to plumb anymore. Because she's 55, she had planned to stop at 40. Your knees go, you know, when you're a plumber.
Oh, I bet, yeah, of course. Amazing. A world I didn't know existed.
Well, but I mean, we got a message on Facebook the other day from a woman whose 9-year-old wanted to be a plumber, Molly, and all the other girls at school were laughing at her. And she said, she's really gone down in the dumps, and can you send her any encouragement?
Yeah, yeah.
So first I just was doing it with our own plumbers, and then I thought, this has to go wider. So I took her name out and I put something on Twitter about, you know, this is why we need to be a company of women plumbers. And there's some guys as well, everybody's sending messages of support in for her.
Oh,
but
great.
Somebody said, we should do a tour of schools.
Yeah.
And there is this thing where people go along and say, draw me a firefighter, and draw me, and then they bring out women, don't they? And but somebody said, you know, we should have a national tour, construction women's tour.
Mm.
And I thought, okay, well, come to the conference, we can set up a group and you can organise doing that, because I'm not going to organise doing that, I'm doing enough actually, but I will facilitate it happening for somebody else to make that happen.
Yeah. I think it's a fantastic idea.
Yeah, and we probably could get some funding for it as well.
How, a lot of people, and it was kind of in the media at the time, talked about the baby being born at Greenham, and I'm wondering if you saw any children at the camp.
Well, I saw the baby being born.
Did you? Jay?
Yeah, he must be
four.
Oh my goodness, a proper man now.
Yeah, late 30s or something.
Yeah, there were a lot of children. Quite a lot of the women that I knew had children. Some of the women had their children with them some of the time.
Mm.
Some of the women were there sometimes because they always had their children with them. I was there when Jay was born. In fact, my friend, whose name is Jay, who I did put her in touch with Becca.
Mm.
When Sarah was giving birth to Jay, she got tired, and the midwives helping her got tired, and Jay was holding her because she's a big woman at the moment that he was actually born.
Wow.
And her name is now Jay, which it was not at the time. She was called Hex at the time. But yeah, so and she lives near here. You might get to speak to her, probably, for the local person.
That's incredible. So was the midwife on site already?
Well,
Or was she a Greenham woman?
No, I think they were in contact with the radical midwives.
Okay.
And they came out specifically because Sarah contacted them quite deliberately.
Yeah.
And she was very clear that she wanted to give birth at the camp.
Yeah.
Even though I think she had to go in hospital just after. I think she was quite poorly, and I think Jay was too.
Yeah, I just always found that... All right. I always found that story just completely incredible.
Mm.
And
I was totally gobsmacked myself.
Yeah.
And she was involved doing loads of actions throughout her entire pregnancy.
Yeah. What a thing as well, just...
She was really cool, actually. I didn't appreciate at the time how cool she was to have done that. But looking back... Oh, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know that.
No, maybe I'm confusing it with somebody else. No, I think I'm getting confused. Yeah, I always just thought, what an amazing thing, what a legacy, not a legacy, what a identity to have.
Yeah.
As being born then. We're nearly at the end anyway. And we kind of touched on this, but could you explain why you think it's important for future generations to know about Greenham?
I think it's really important that women's history is no longer lost.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think, I get very frustrated that because of the way that women's history is lost, each generation has to learn things afresh, and each generation is inventing the wheel. So no wonder we're not going as far as we should.
Mm-hmm.
And so by it being brought back out into awareness, we can start, people can learn from our mistakes and take it to the next stage and the next stage and the next stage, rather than everybody just repeating the same mistakes over and over. And if we're going to evolve, which I sometimes wonder when I look at what's happening in the world at the minute, whether we are going to give ourselves any opportunity to evolve at all, but if we are, then we absolutely have to start learning.
Yeah.
It's stupidness, it's madness to just do the same things again and again, but if people don't know, then we will.
Yeah.
But, you know, an example of how what a mad state we're in with the world, I think.
I agree. I think it's... I was having a conversation in another interview, and the lady brought up the conversation around gender and the kind of upcoming pregnancies, and she was like, we have these discussions at Greenham, like, we did it all, like, why are people forgetting that this
is and I remember, and I do think, I think the current debate around gender, I think it's extremely divisive, and it's not only... It's divisive between transsexuals and transvestites, to use the old terminology, because people who've gone through the process and actually changed their physical bodies are being left out of this entire debate.
Mm.
But I do remember somebody turning up and saying, I'm a woman with polka dot high heel peak toe shoes on and a matching polka dot dress.
Mm.
And we said, and so how are you going to cope in the mud then?
Mm.
And I also remember a gay guy friend of mine saying, you see, it's the bloody lesbians who are doing this, not us. We couldn't even go and do it because we wouldn't have anywhere to pluck our hair dryer in. The gay men were not capable of doing it because their culture was taking them to be in a different way.
Yeah.
No, it was not possible for other groups to do it. It was a certain bunch of radicalised women who were... rejecting what we were told women had to be like.
Yeah.
So it wasn't only lesbians by a long chalk, by a very long chalk actually, but it was women who were radicalised to a very particular degree, or who went and became very quickly radicalised because they saw something that they needed and wanted and or recognised and, you know, been looking for on some level.
Mm.
And I'm sure that that's what happened to me, was that there was a gap that I got there, and it was like, oh yeah, I'm getting that now.
Mm. That's beautiful.